This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, and today, in honour of the International Day of Happiness, I'm speaking with Carol Graham, Leo Pospolsky Senior Fellow and Research Director at the Brookings Institution. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Carol.
Good morning, and happy to be here with you.
So now, most of us know that happiness indexes, for example, exist, and that, you know, Finland comes in as the happiest country in the world, according to the World Happiness Report. But help us to break it down. You know, how is happiness actually measured?
Right. The national averages don't tell us all that much more than we already know. So countries that are wealthier and healthier and have good environments score higher than countries that are poor and violent and have terrible environments. And then there are differences even, you know, within wealthy countries. You see, for example, the U.S. scoring much lower because we have terrible health care and high levels of inequality and our public goods aren't very good. So all those things factor into when you think about reported well-being or subjective well-being, and happiness is one component. So how do we measure this? So we measure this at the individual level, which is where you get the most robust patterns and where I think you get the most meaningful variations. But knowing, for example, that across individuals, that people who participate in volunteering or, you know, all kinds of other different things based on health and sociability and productivity and creativity, all these things factor in at the individual level. And that's really where we do most of the measurement effort. So what we do is we have large numbers of observations of people across the world, within countries, across countries, and we break down well-being, as we think of the broader umbrella, into three dimensions. One is evaluative well-being, and that's essentially how people evaluate their lives as a whole. How satisfied are they with their lives as a whole? Because happiness, it's the most popular term, but the least well-defined. We measure how people think of their lives. And for young people, that includes the opportunities they think they'll have, their aspirations and expectations. For older people, they look back on what they've done over their life. And then we measure what we call hedonic or experienced well-being, how people experience their daily lives, their moods, positive or negative, and we can match the moods to the activities. So we know, for example, commuting time is a very miserable part of the day, and time with friends is a happy part of the day. And there's a third dimension that we've started to measure explicitly, which is eudaimonic well-being, and that's Aristotle's concept of happiness, which combines eu, which in Greek means wealth or you know, abundance, and then daemon, which is the Greek word for control over your own destiny. And so there we actually explicitly ask people, do you have meaning or purpose in your life, right, on the same 10, 11-point scale that we ask life satisfaction. And we find that that measure is pretty close to life satisfaction and other evaluative measures, but it does have some different properties. And how people define meaning and purpose varies a little bit across cultures.
So, I mean, that was actually the question I had, the fact that different people have different values across cultures and countries. So how do you go about being able to objectively compare, say, Denmark and Oman, considering the different cultural contexts of each country?
Right. First of all, let me even take a step back and explain to you how we measure even what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So we have these, you know, millions of observations. And we have econometric equations. I know you probably don't want to hear too much about those, but there's a little, just bear with me for a couple of minutes, because understanding this makes it obvious why this is a robust measurement science and not just running around asking people what makes them happy, which is not what we're doing. So we have, in the beginning of the surveys, we have the battery of well-being questions, which run from how satisfied are you with your life as a whole to were you stressed frequently yesterday, yes or no? Did you smile frequently yesterday, yes or no? Do you have meaning and purpose in your life? All of the well-being questions are in the front of the survey, so that you don't want to ask somebody how satisfied are they with their life as a whole or even with their day if you've just asked three questions about, say, the state of their marriage or the state of their job. And then we take a whole host of socioeconomic and demographic data via questions about their age, about their income, about their health status. So we know that money and means matter, but they aren't the only thing. Health matters actually more to people's well-being. There's a U-shaped curve between happiness and age that holds across populations everywhere. Its low point is in the kind of mid-40s to the late or mid-50s, depending on the country. And that's a pretty remarkable thing across everybody around the world, with the exceptions of very poor countries or very violent countries where it's just terrible to age. Even this age curve holds in chimpanzees, which is crazy, but it does. So there's something biological to this, which makes it, when you think about measuring human well-being and not just using income measures and using these different measures, we are capturing some things that are genetic or biological and that sort of are germane to all humans, wherever they are, culture aside. So, you know, we have these huge samples, around the world samples, but we also have, the samples are divided up by countries. And so what we do is we create something called country fixed effects or country dummies, in which we cluster the responses of people from this the same country. We can also do the same state or the same county, but given you're talking around the world, we'll do the country. And what that clustering does is we're still observing these people compared to people all over the world, but the clustering of the country cluster or the country fixed effects basically picks up the error that is common to the responses of most people from the same country, right? So, for example, we find people in Latin America smile more than almost anywhere else, which is an interesting thing. But if you're trying to control for cultural or regional or country differences, we then control for that so that we compare their scores, sort of taking out those country differences.
Interesting. So now, Carol, I also wanted to look at some specific countries, perhaps, which might use happiness as a metric for policy. You know, what is your gauge of countries like this? And, you know, what are some of the challenges, perhaps, that they've seen when they try to take happiness and well-being into account in policy formation?
Right. So that's a great question. And there, I have to say, you know, I have quite a distinct view on this, having been involved in it from day one, when we never, you know, we didn't think economists, I am an economist, but you know, in the beginning, we weren't taken very seriously by other economists. And I never believed that we'd get to a point that, you know, statistics offices in countries around the world would be using these metrics in a serious way for budgeting or policy planning or everything else. And it's very exciting. But they're sort of selling ministries of happiness or gross national happiness, as the Bhutanese do. It's a lovely country, and they are doing some interesting stuff. But what they're doing isn't really gross national happiness, and it's a bit confounding, in my view, to the public, versus what the Brits are doing. They have, in their national statistics since 2011, they include four measures of well-being. One is life satisfaction, the evaluative measure. The other is anxiety yesterday, and related to that, a second measure, which is contentment yesterday or smiling yesterday, which measure the hedonic elements of well-being, and then they have meaning and purpose. So four questions that are collected along with every other statistic, like income, health statistics, everything else, in their national statistical survey. And then they report the trends across people, across age groups, across districts, as they report all their other national statistics every year. Then you have New Zealand that has placed well-being at the forefront of their budgeting process. And that's also a very robust approach. Again, they're not sort of selling, you know, we have a ministry of happiness and we're going to make everybody happy. And that's kind of the danger when countries take that route.
Carol, so could you elaborate a little bit on Bhutan? Because you mentioned that the situation there is a little bit confounding, and you don't necessarily agree with their take on gross national happiness. Why is that?
So I think I very much agree with what the Bhutanese have done in terms of policy, mm-hmm. and that it's robustly done. I think the labeling it gross national happiness is what is confusing. So what they did, they did a well-being study of their country along the lines of what I have said. From that study, they determined what were the most important factors to well-being in their country, and they made those priorities in their development strategy, right? So it's a very enlightened development strategy for a very, very poor country, much more enlightened than most, and I applaud that. It just really isn't gross national happiness, because I'm not sure what that term would imply. They're still doing, you know, basic development strategy, trying to reduce poverty, which is an income issue, not only, but it requires getting people out of income poverty. They have a good health strategy, good education strategy. All those things are not really distinct from what we would call good development policy. They focus on psychological well-being, and that's a very enlightened thing that does depart from other countries. But essentially what they're doing is not all that different from, say, what New Zealand is doing. And New Zealand may have been influenced by what Bhutan is doing, in the sense that they're using what we know from well-being surveys to prioritize their government's policies, but neither one is saying, okay, we're replacing GNP with gross national happiness, we're throwing out income-based measures. Do you see what I mean? So it's, I think that the most powerful way the use of life satisfaction, happiness, and other metrics in both in economics and in policy and in government policy is when we include these robust measures as complements to what we already have in our GNP metrics, and often those will highlight different priorities. They will highlight what income tells us makes people happy. Sometimes doesn't do that at all. And we know GMP miscounts, so it counts pollution as a plus if it's oil production, right? So they're very important complements, but I feel very strongly that we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, and that we have these other metrics that also matter to measuring progress. To me, it's as much about packaging this or presenting it to the public in a robust and nuanced way and not try and sell it as some cure-all is important to it being effective in really making people's lives better.
I've been speaking with Carol Graham, Leo Pozwolski, Senior Fellow and Research Director at the Brookings Institution. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. In honour of the International Day of Happiness, I'm speaking with Carol Graham, Leo Pozwolski, Senior Fellow and Research Director at the Brookings Institution. Now, Carol, also as part of your research, you looked into the link between inequality and unhappiness and a support for populist leaders. So basically, if the U.S., for example, if the U.S. Was happier overall, would it be the case that we wouldn't have Donald Trump in the White House?
Well, I would do anything to not have Donald Trump in the White House, but that's not the question you asked. Yes, well, okay, so there are many things merged into that. What we find just in terms of the basic relationship between inequality and happiness or life satisfaction is it depends, which I know is a very academic, wiggly response, but it really does. So if inequality signals sort of a system that's fair and it signals opportunity and everybody could get ahead, which it used to signal in the United States in the height of our, you know, high levels of mobility, it can be a positive signal and it can correlate positively with well-being. If inequality signals sort of persistent advantage for some groups and persistent disadvantage for others, then it tends to come in negative in terms of the relationship between inequality and happiness. What you've got in the U.S. is a combination of rapidly rising inequality, very much driven by the richest and everybody else, which is not a healthy thing, because it isn't a rising tide lifting all boats at all. If you look at the incomes of the very rich, they've gone up and up and up, and median income has been stagnant for at least a decade. And then related to that, but not only an inequality-related issue, is just the decline of the quality and the availability of work for people with less than a college education. So basically blue-collar and manufacturing and mining jobs, which have faded with structural changes in the world economy, with technology-driven growth, with all sorts of other things. And they weren't necessarily glamorous jobs, but they were jobs that gave sort of the, particularly the white blue-collar working class in the United States, identity, narrative, status, respect, and they're gone. And so what you have is a group of people who had privileged access to those jobs, because it was primarily white males that had privileged access to those jobs, and they've fallen behind in a very sad way, at the same time that minorities have sort of had the system stacked against them and kept on going and were better multitaskers. And, you know, so they're sort of doing better, actually, in relative terms in these difficult times. That isn't so, I don't know if that's an inequality story, but it is a story of life purpose and sort of losing not just your job, but your community. And the blame for what have been structural changes in the world economy and significant portions of the working class doing relatively worse than they were before, the blame, which Trump has been very effective at elocuting, is let's blame immigrants, let's blame minorities. They're catching up with us. They've taken our jobs. None of which is true. Populist governments everywhere over time, that's what they do. They generate, you know, they pick up on people's fear, on people's frustrations. And it's a lot easier to be successful if you have somebody to blame. It's also tearing our society apart right now, so it's not a productive strategy, but it tends to work politically. And it, you know, it isn't just Trump. Look at Brexit in the UK. Look at some of the other right-wing populist governments that have popped up in Europe. The themes are very similar. And it really has to do with giant changes in the nature of work, in the world economy, in the rewards to skilled versus unskilled labor that we all have to deal with, we all have to be creative about. We need new kinds of training, we need new kinds of vocational education. We need to, in the U.S., very much rejuvenate dying communities that are full of deaths of despair and everything else that are just non-functional right now. And yes, inequality plays into that story, but it isn't just simple measured national inequality. It's inequality in hope, inequality in relationships, inequality in stable family structures and access to health care, a whole bunch of things that are much more about kind of the whole social structure being very frayed in the U.S., more so than I think in comparative countries in Europe. And yes, that has led to a big drop in happiness, in national average happiness in the past 10 years. We've gone from being sort of number 10 in the World Happiness Report since we started with the World Happiness Report, maybe it's worth sort of finishing with it, to being number 17. And we are one of the wealthiest countries in the world. So that's a sign that something is woefully wrong.
So I guess for a last question, Carol, I mean, we are in the midst of what's rapidly turning out to be a global pandemic. And here at BFM, we've covered it from all kinds of angles, from economic angles to public policy. But what kind of an impact do you expect this to also have on happiness levels within the countries affected?
I hate to be pessimistic, but it's not going to be good. So look at in addition to obviously, ill health and a lot of mortality, particularly for older people, not only. The only way we can stop it seems to be, and except for the countries that have been really good at nipping it in the bud, and I hope you guys are, and better than we have been, is this social distancing, right? And basically, social distancing requires shutting down big sectors of the economy that tend to be sectors where low-skilled workers who are already threatened, who are already vulnerable, who have worse quality jobs and more and a lot of instability in their lives, it's a huge blow, right, at that level. But the other thing, everything we know about the sort of people's well-being around the world, everywhere, is that social connections, social support, family ties, friendship ties, all these things are incredibly important in helping people cope and adapt to hard times. Obviously, they aren't lost forever, but the in-person contact you know, the community support mechanisms that are so important to higher levels of well-being everywhere we studied it are being severely challenged. So you're kind of adding an additional layer of negativity in terms of labor force trends that are associated with lower levels of well-being. And then you're also taking a hammer to the coping mechanisms.
So if that's the case, you know, what should governments do? You know, it very much does seem like they're caught between a rock and a hard place, right? It's choose between the health and safety of your population and their well-being, in fact, or on the converse side, it's, you know, it's the economy and whether or not, when do you restart it and potentially risk the virus starting to spread again?
I think the first order priority is to ride this out till this virus is dormant. I think, you know, it's just, at times you just have to make very difficult choices. But if, you know, I think we've seen that social distancing can flatten this curve and quash, you know, and prevent an epidemic from, or of a you know, infectious disease from becoming more of a pandemic than it already is. And in places that do it effectively, they're able to basically get over the virus as such a large threat, you know, over some time, and it takes time and patience. If we sort of stop halfway through and change course and it becomes an even worse epidemic, then the fallout's going to be even bigger for economies, for life, you know, people's, you know, in terms of mortality rates, and ultimately the long-term well-being effects would just be longer. So I'm not suggesting we can or should do otherwise. I think every single country has had the chance to limit the damage early on, and it strikes me that countries where the virus is just surfacing, like my native country, Peru, are already doing social distancing measures with a very small number of cases, and it sounds like you all in Malaysia seem to be doing the same. I do think we also find surprising pockets of resilience and people's ability to help each other out in these periods that should give us some hope. We're headed for some more troubled waters ahead before this is over.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning, Carol. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Carol Graham, Leo Pozvolsky, Senior Fellow and Research Director at the Brookings Institution, here in conjunction with International Day of Happiness. Be sure to stay tuned for more conversations after this. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.